The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. We are on iTunes under Writers on Writing. We're on Stitcher and however else you consume your podcasts, we are likely there. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every week, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking these days. Today's book and subject matter has such astounding relevance to the things we're living through. It was written over the past few years, pre-2020, pre-George Floyd, but the themes and ideas have only become accelerated since its writing, so I'm happy we're getting a chance to talk about this memoir in essays, Beyond Repair. I'm with Sebastian Matthews for the full hour. Sebastian is the author of the memoir In My Father's Footsteps and two books of poetry, We Generous and Miracle Day. His hybrid collection of poetry and prose, Beginner's Guide to a Head-On Collision, won the Independent Publishers Book Awards Silver Medal. Sebastian is the author of The Life and Times of American Crow, a collage of novels and 11 chapbooks. His work has appeared in or on, among other places, The Atlantic, Blackbird, The Common, Georgia Review, Poetry Daily, Poets and Writers, The Sun, Virginia Quarterly, on and on. Today, as I said, we're talking about his latest memoir and essays, Beyond Repair, Encounters in a Fractured World. It's published by Red Hen Press, one of my favorite presses, and it will drive our discussion this morning. Sebastian, welcome.
Oh, thank you. And I'm glad that you're a big Red Hen fan.
I love the books that come out of there. It's such a great press. So we have the luxury of time this morning. So I thought maybe we could just start with you talking about your path into writing, becoming a poet and a writer. You know, if that was always on the docket or if it found you later in life or just kind of how that process happened.
Yeah, you know, I'm the son of two writers, actually son of two poets. And then also my stepdad is a photographer, and my brother's a musician and a drummer, and my aunt's a dancer and a teacher. It's kind of, we joke, it's gringo griot. We're a kind of family of teachers and artists. So I feel like it was in the cards one way or the other. I think I just fell in love with the feel of the life that I saw my parents living. They lived separately. They divorced when I was five, but they both had lots of books and a lot of artist friends and writers over, and I'd go to their readings, and it just seemed like, okay, this is the way to do it. You know, I saw myself as a writer, I think, since I was a kid. So for better or for worse, I was in it from the beginning.
Was it always kind of the way this book feels and some of the other books that you've written feel, it feels like you approach writing as sort of a way to process the world. I mean, not writing as therapy, but writing as a way to kind of understand what's going on and understand what's happened to you, as opposed to fiction and inventive worlds don't feel as interesting to you, perhaps. I don't know if I'm getting that right or wrong, obviously, because I don't know you, but is that kind of how you approach it, is a way of digesting and understanding what's going on around you?
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, it's so funny, when I was in high school, college, and then going into grad school, for me, the real love was fiction, and very much like Borges and Calvino and all the kind of fabulists. And I have that side of me as well. And The Life and Times of American Crow pushes that a little further than I've gone before. But very much so, I think, in poetry and in creative nonfiction. And now what I'm seeing more and more for me as a hybrid combination of the two, with images as well, is definitely processing and using real life as a springboard, real life experience as a springboard into the lyric or short essay or an encounter, a dispatch, I could call them. So yeah, it's I'm not too worried about that kind of therapy label. People are worried about it. I feel like whatever helps us get through this life is a good thing. You know, I take long walks to keep myself sane, and I think I write to keep sane, and that's true for a lot of folks.
We should bring up, because it's sort of the subtext of this book, the accident that you happened, I think it was in 2011.
Yes.
And if you feel like your writing changed in the aftermath of that, certainly the subject matter of your writing seemed to change in the aftermath of that. And I feel like probably important to just get that out on the table, kind of what you went through. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, it's on the table right here. I brought it out because it really is the subtext is a good way to put it. I think it was kind of underpinning, or the beginning, the first book that the Beyond Repair follows. And I would say that accident, of course, you know, changed me the most. And so I think it definitely changed my writing. It altered everything. And we survived it, my wife and I and our boy, and came through it and had to take a long period of time to recover. And the book Beginner's Guide is really kind of a look at those 3 years of coming out of such a severe accident and then the trauma and kind of PTSD really that came from it and didn't become clear really until a couple of years later. So that really is the underpinning of the book, and it threads through lightly in Beyond Repair, mostly through my relationship to my son, who was 8 at the time of the accident, and is by the time of the Beyond Repair, he's a young teen, and when the book ends, he's a junior in high school. And as trying to parent him, I found ways that I was still stuck in some trauma modes that he would point out, trigger states, you know. And so the book, I meant to keep it out of the book, but it kept coming back in. And I ended up starting Beyond Repair with the most memoirish piece that sets that state of kind of extended PTSD, even 3 or 4 years out, as the ground from which Beyond Repair moves forward.
Yeah, because it sort of became the lens through which you now viewed the world. Like, you had endured this trauma, you kind of woke up, I guess is one way to put it, into a world that was much different than the world you kind of extracted yourself from in 2011. And it's interesting. It'll be interesting in the future to see if that is the lens that keeps going, right? That if that's the lens through which you view everything from here on out, it seems hard for it not to be. I mean, it'll change, but it seems hard for it not to be.
It seems to be. And I'd add that that idea of a hybrid form is also a radical shift, and that won't change for me. That I think I'm kind of come out of the writerly closet as a hybrid artist after the accident and as a collaborator. So just being a poet, I never felt that was true for me. Just being a fiction writer, never really, but I've always loved fiction, just being a memoirist. So for me, the hybrid form, but definitely, you know, everything changed after that accident, and my approach to writing did too.
So I'll let you, we've kind of talked around the collection, but I'm going to let you do a better job of introducing it than I have. Can you sort of talk about Beyond Repair and how it's organized, what was on your mind, and kind of how it came about?
Well, how you just described kind of like waking up from, you know, a period of time after 2011 and suddenly it's 2014 and I'm trying to get literally reacquainted with the world. I was pretty much a hermit for a couple of years. It was like, oh, I thought I knew this world. There goes Obama, here comes Trump is one way to put it. And another is what I felt was kind of in the air before the accident for me, a sense of the country being split a little bit or a lot, and a kind of us versus them feeling seemed to have been micro, you know, magnified, you know, starting 2014, 2015. And I really couldn't tell at first, was I triggered, you know, fight, flight or freeze? For me, I fight. So, you know, was I overreacting to all this stuff that I felt while I was driving, when I was walking down the street, when I was interacting with people in stores, you know, as I began to travel, it felt really hostile and very certainly fraught. And then that's when I kind of realized, well, maybe there's a kind of PTSD, a cultural PTSD that I'm walking into that I'm either overreacting to and or seeing more clearly than most because of what I just went through. So that's kind of maybe the lens you were talking about. So then the project became, well, what do I do to connect with people when I feel so disconnected, both personally, but also feeling like kind of like I'd woke up to a different place or a stranger in a strange land. And so I thought, well, encounters. And what I realized that a third or so of the beginner's guide were also encounters. And they were also these kind of prose pieces or prose poems that were just describing interactions. And so I thought, well, maybe I can keep writing those and maybe I can, but they're not just writing them. I went out as a kind of a reporter and I wanted to actually start interacting with people differently and with different people in different places. And I think I have to add that Claudia Rankine's Citizen was a big influence because I read it around that time. And her early part of that book with the microaggressions and the descriptions of these encounters really blew me away. And I felt is there a way for a white middle-class, middle-aged man like me to look at some of the things that she was looking at from my side? And so that was also part of the kind of project's challenge, self-challenge.
We should also mention that you've got some great photographs, quotes, art. Art in here. I don't know if those were photographs that you took as well?
Yeah, I was taking photographs. I call them snaps because I'm no real photographer, but I've been taking photographs since I was a kid, and my stepfather's this photographer, and I've always felt that the snapshot was a great art form, street photography. So I took a small collection of what I thought were the best images that were best, meaning most relating to the material. But I also really wanted to try to not take pictures that were straight on of people. I wanted to look at encounters from a more graphic, visual way. So they're kind of surreal and a little bit off kilter photographs. I wanted quotes in there. This is part of the mosaic collage that I was trying to make here. These were a lot of short pieces, so they were kind of put into a quilt or a mosaic. And then there are the headlines in the middle of the book that I had initially put them throughout the book, but I felt like in some ways it'd be better to have them right in the center there. And these are headlines that are basically from actual headlines describing all the things happening between 2011 and 2019, all the unarmed black men being shot, all the shooters, all the mass killings. And I wanted that to be there as a backdrop for this very personal story.
The interesting thing about reading this book, I think it's coming out pretty contemporaneously now, and digesting this book through the other lens of what we are now in, which hadn't yet happened. George Floyd killing, as I said, had not yet happened when this was written. And so the book, of course, has just become more and more relevant, more and more urgent since you finished writing it, I imagine, and finished editing it. And I don't know if there was any prescience on your part of things were just becoming more and more intense and this book would become more and more true as time went on. You seem to have that sense that things were going to escalate, certainly, and not de-escalate.
Well, yeah, I don't know exactly how on the big picture I was feeling that way, but I certainly woke up really woke up to, what am I mean to be an anti-racist? And these are some of the themes that are really, in white liberal circles right now, for sure. There's a sense of we need to really deal with some of the stuff that maybe we kind of thought we were dealing with or we hadn't dealt with individually, organizationally. And I had begun to encounter some of this 4 or 5 years ago through some friends, through the Kalalu workshops. And I really kind of felt like I had woken to something radical for me. And so the trying to deal with white privilege and white fragility and white shame and looking at what it might be to be an anti-racist was something that was new, but really important to me. And I feel like in that way, I might be a few steps ahead of some people, but wow, we're so behind. And I definitely, in one sense, the George Floyd, the response to his murder, I think we've had that response for years now, but I think it really was a flashpoint. So luckily, it's come, full out that we need to deal with this inequity on all these levels.
Right. The original subtitle of the book was Off-White in America, I feel like I read somewhere.
It's had so many. And actually, the title that's on the book, the subtitle is Living in a Fractured State. We changed it.
Oh.
changed so many times. Yeah, the idea of being off-white was a bad joke, and that's why I took it off, is that there's a point in the book where I was talking to a young black woman, and she kind of said something and she realized that she might have offended me about calling Trump this awful white man. And I was like, hey, listen, if that's white, I don't want to be white. And, and of course that's a desire that is something that should be examined. But at the same time, the idea of, I don't really own or want to be owned by this idea of being white. I think it's a construct. So off-white might be a way to say, yeah, I know where I come from. I know what privilege I have, what systems I'm from, but I also don't want to be a part of it. And that's where I think active effort to be an anti-racist, as Kendi puts it, not a racist, is where I think I'm headed and where I think a lot of people are trying to be head.
We should give nod, we're here in Southern California, but we should talk a little bit about where you live, because I feel like perhaps you were sort of the canary in the coal mine for a lot of us, middle-class white liberals who were, especially here in California, who were completely inside our bubble and really, were blindsided by the election in 2016. And you seem like you had seen a lot of this coming based on where you live. Can you talk a little bit about, do you live in Asheville?
Yeah, I live in Asheville, North Carolina, which is in the mountains. It's western, you know, western part of the state, and it's mountain south. It's pretty north for the south, but it's south, and it's a very liberal city. I always call it the Brooklyn of the South, but it reminds me of different neighborhoods in Seattle or a little bit like Venice or Santa Monica. You know, it's a hip little place. And it's got a lot of active art and music and culture. It's been also really an incredible place right now for activism around these issues. You know, there's a group that's trying to get the city council to approach reparations at a county level, and their county's listening. So it's a very white. I wouldn't say it's just a white place because it's actually got lots of diversity, but it seems white because there's a kind of white ownership to the place. I don't think people understood they didn't see that, but now they do maybe. So yeah, you know, we live in a little blue, but you know, a little blue speck inside a very red county. We live in what seems like a little northern mountain town in the middle of the South. So it's a kind of an interesting place to be.
I really love the way these essays, it just feels like the way you pay particular attention in the world to, you know, kind of what other people might see as banal or I don't know, inconsequential encounters, your writerly eye is really on. And you're then able to sort of see the subtext of what's going on in an encounter that somebody might not otherwise pay attention to. And I feel like that's some sort of writerly training, perhaps. But tell me just like how you live in the world as a writer paying attention. Are your eyes always attuned to how you could turn something into an essay, or does something in hindsight come to you and say that would be a good essay?
I think it's a little bit of both, and it's definitely a training. I feel like I try to be as awake as I can in my life, and I know I have my sleepwalking moments, but I feel like there's no excuse now in my cultural life or in my life with other people where I go out and travel. If I go into the city, to New York City, or out to Seattle, or if I go into the country to different towns, I am just wide awake. I want to pay attention to whatever's going on. I want to take interesting photographs. I want to take little, you know, mental snapshots so that maybe I can, you know, pay attention to the kind of what's the paradigm. It's a horrible word, but I love it, in terms of what's really happening and how would I know as an outsider. And how does that, you know, there's a great idea of being an idiot dog. It comes from this anthropologist friend, that a friend of his was out in the bush somewhere and he got lost, and he ended up staying with this in this village. And the leader of the village finally became clear that the name for that this PhD anthropologist was idiot dog. Because for the guy who was the leader of that town, the shaman, was this guy didn't even know how to find water. He didn't even know where he was. So for me, trying not to be an idiot dog is kind of one of my goals as a writer. So you got to talk to people, you got to pay attention. That may sound a little silly, but it really is kind of a working philosophy. And I didn't know it at the time, but there's a hashtag now called Watch Whiteness Happen. And I found that when I began to make it a project to look at moments when there were microaggressions that I might be a part of, or I call them micro awkwardnesses or micro misconnections, you see it everywhere. And you see people trying or not trying, or being oblivious, or being really, you know, really hostile on purpose. And so I start to try to inhabit those spaces and then write about them.
My guest this morning is Sebastian Matthews. The book we are talking about, Beyond Repair, A Memoir and Essays. And now I have the subtitle wrong. Tell me the new subtitle.
Living in a Fractured State.
So this is probably a good time to introduce one of those essays now that we've talked about kind of how you go about them. I don't know which is the best to start with. Should we do White Dad's Shoes?
Well, maybe maybe the first piece, White Men and Trucks, because in some ways it really is a true encounter where, in this case, as you'll see, I'm the one that ends up kind of making the misread or being kind of the jerk in the story. White Men and Trucks. What is it about them that shoots a brief goose of fear into my bloodstream? Is it imminent threat sounding in the revved engine, derision caught in the side view mirror, or plain old disdain drumming its fingers on the driver's side door? A little of each? All I know is I am walking through our suburban neighborhood and a truck barrels past, not slowing nor moving over. but another swerves around the bend, almost clipping my dog, meeting my upraised hands with a jutted middle finger. And another drives right up behind me and rides my bumper all the way up the hill. Just yesterday, downtown Asheville, a man steps around me in line and interrupts the conversation I'm having with an acquaintance. He is showing me a photo of his five-year-old boy holding up a large fish caught in one of the Biltmore ponds. The man steps in closer. That a bream? He's got a smile on his face that I read as hostile. He wants me gone, but the father ignores the man, finishing his sentence about the peaceful water and how quiet it is out there with his boy. Almost mystical, he says. The man interrupts again, smile getting bigger. Hey, Mike, that a bream your boy is holding? Mike bursts into an equally large smile. Hell no, he drawls, and lists all the fish his boy has or could have caught. I don't fish, so I don't follow, nor can I make sense of the quick-fire exchange. The two men have fallen into a bravado-fueled, friendly back and forth. It's as if they're flashing each other signs or showing each other their good old boy credentials. I feel as though I am being erased from the moment. No trespassing signs staked to my feet. The men chat and laugh in the corner as I slip back in line. Later, at dusk, one more truck appears. It slows to a crawl and follows me up the street. What's with people these days? Are they so sick of their lives that they need to lash out at strangers? To hate them for being something foreign or different? I turn to face my nemesis, who has rolled down the window. What do you want? The man smiles, remains silent. There's power in a comfort with silence. How old is that dog of yours? He asks, leaning out the window. He's talking about the lab, just a puppy, bounding over and standing up as if seeking the man's arms. The man laughs. The look in his eyes is pure sadness.
That's so great. That's Sebastian Matthews reading from his book Beyond Repair, or White Men in Trucks. I'm glad you brought this one up because there's so much to talk about with this one. From the time of the event that this happened, there's two events, but they happened a day apart. Did you decide to write this piece? And did you write the piece?
It was early on. It was probably 2013. I had broken both my legs and my feet, and broken one leg and both my feet, and a lot of, I was really a mess. I had to learn how to walk again, basically. So I was really fragile on these roads. These are suburban roads that don't have sidewalks. And I was pretty uneven on my feet and kind of in pain. So anything that kind of pushed me, like people driving too close or driving too fast, or, you know, really got me, because I would get really pissed. So that's the kind of context of, so this piece was the first piece that I wrote where I was, because I came back and I realized, as I often do, I told the experience to my wife and she looked at me kind of like, God, you are just chill out, you know? And, but what I realized in that conversation was, wow, I really misread that guy, but I was primed to misread him. And so maybe I was being misread by the other folks. Maybe I was giving signals to them that made them pissed at me. So that's a piece that comes early in that process. And there's another piece called Her Hair, where a much more positive experience where I was really distracted, but a woman came near me and it was like the elevator doors were closing and she looked at me and said, you know, where am I? And I stopped and I opened the door and I said, you know, where do you want to go? And it turns out she had Alzheimer's. And so just by luck almost, I got out of my own way and was able to help somebody. So these are kind of different sides of the same kind of near encounter or encounter through difference or you know, whatever that might be.
Right. And when did you physically write it compared to when the event happened? Oh,
I wrote it as soon as I had that conversation. I wrote it that night.
Wow.
Yeah. I often write, you know, as I walk, not literally, like I don't bring a pen and pencil, but I, as a poet, I've been trained. You got to capture that. If you got something coming, you got to capture the first line and you got to get its music, right? If it's a particular sentence or a couple lines, you got to memorize it as is, because whatever is going to come out of it with any real strength or real depth comes out of the actual music of the words. And I think it's true for prose. So I probably had a couple lines in my head or something. And then when I talked to her, I sat down and it just came.
That's really interesting. The other thing that I wanted to point out about this piece, and a lot of your pieces do this, is you have an encounter and then you'll have, as this one does, a mirroring encounter, a different encounter, but one that resonates or contrasts or reinforces or something to the other encounter. And so you juxtapose those two together and it's so effective. It allows us to understand things in a deeper, different, contrasting way. And I thought that was just a wonderful I don't know if the word is device, but a wonderful way to deepen our understanding of what you're experiencing in each situation. It also strikes me how much a lot of these encounters are with other white men, and you almost always seem like you're from a different species.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a freak. It's part of it. But I also come, I read as a pretty straight, pretty normal looking guy in his 50s. So it's maybe a little, I feel different than the way I come across. But yeah, you know, I definitely, you know, and that's part of what I think is going on now in this new hyper divided, divisive world, is that I think people feel like the other person, the person maybe who's the, I'm this and they're that, or you're this and you're that. We feel worlds apart. And, you know, I grew up all over the country. My parents were divorced. I moved everywhere. I lived in cities. I lived in countries. I lived in communities where, you know, of different cultures and backgrounds. So for me, I never really felt uncomfortable being around. There's a piece where I'm taking my boy and his friends to a paintball place in rural Mill Valley, kind of outside of Asheville. And one of the kids, I kind of said a few things about I didn't really like the scene. I don't really like guns. And one of the kids says, "Well, you don't like rednecks?" And I'm like, "Well, first of all, I don't like that word, but no, I'm comfortable around people from the country. That's not a problem. It's something else that feels weird to me." So yeah, I hear you. But I'm always trying to bridge the difference when I can, but I guess some of the pieces show when I can't.
That X marks the spot is the essay you're referring to. It's so great. That brings me to the point about the role of your son in these essays, which I also thought was so well handled. I mean, he's obviously a character, he's your son, so he's going to show up in memoir essays. But he also serves as sort of this really interesting, like your conscience, like he'll, out of the mouths of babes, I guess, but he'll say things that you'll be teaching him a lesson, for example, and he'll turn it on you and teach you a lesson in response.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, there's a piece early, and I'd be happy to read it if you want, but it's called Useless, where I said something really inappropriate to a young girl. It wasn't inappropriate in a creepy way, but like it's things that you shouldn't say as an adult to a kid. And I was trying to fix it, and my Avery came back. He was like, you know, 12 at the time or younger, and he said, you know, I said, "Dad, I always make jokes, don't I?" And he's like, "No."
Right. Right.
I don't, you know, and so he totally called me out, and he's good at that.
There was another one where you were telling a homeless man, you know, you were telling Avery, "No one likes to feel invisible." And he said, "You don't do that because of that. You do that because this makes you feel better." Yeah. And I just thought, both as witness to what happened, he acts as both witness and as conscience and as counterpoint. Like his character, aside from just him being in the essays because he's there, is so wonderful. I mean, he's such a great observer and adds such another level of depth and texture to a lot of these essays.
Yeah, he's sharp. And what's interesting was, having been a character in the first book I wrote, my wife asked me really to not really put her too much in this one. And so I had to try to find a way to make sure that people understood that, you know, this is a family this is the kind of family we are. I'm not a single dad, but I really wanted to give her that privacy. A friend of mine, a writer, Kevin McAvoy, who's a brilliant writer, he had read a version of this and he said, "You know, you have a lot of pieces about Avery in there, but you don't seem to be aware of it. And like, maybe you should use that more consciously as a tool, like your relationship to him." So I thank him for that. And as soon as I saw that, it's like a thread, a color thread in the quilt. And I just suddenly brought that kind of red, that thread of whatever the color was. And I just kind of brought it a little more to the front, but I didn't want to bring it all the way to the front because you're right. He plays a subtle role that I could use sparingly, but it would to good effect, I think.
Right, like Schindler's List, where it's all in black and white, but you've got
little
little red. Yeah. Well, and the other thing is that if the kind of context of the book is confronting these issues of racism and whiteness, and it's so important to talk about how a white man teaches his white son about the world. I mean, I just think that's a kind of a critical element as we're trying to navigate these issues for ourselves. We are also teaching them in real time to our kids. And that came through so beautifully while he's challenging you a little bit on your own motivations here and there. I just thought that was really brilliant. So maybe we can take another one of these essays because it's so fun to do this. What did you think about patience? I loved that. It just stayed with me.
This is one of the ones that if my son was there, he would have probably called me on some things, some righteous indignation and some kind of white liberal the urge to fix things or step in and be the savior.
Savior,
you know?
Yeah.
And that is a complex, and I think it's one to avoid if all possible. And it's one probably I didn't avoid here, but I was aware of it at the time. So let me just read it. It's the same length as the other one. And I wrote this on the flight almost immediately after. Two flight attendants take drink orders from the passengers in the seats before you. You are sitting on the aisle in an emergency exit row not far from the first class partition. A woman is waiting in the aisle across from you. She's returning from the mid-cabin restroom and is blocked by the cart. You see the flight attendant nod to the woman and hold up your finger. A few minutes later, looking up from your book, you are surprised to discover the woman still waiting, now for close to 5 minutes. The woman in the other aisle seat watches the scene unfold, shaking her head in disgust. The two flight attendants are white women and the waiting passenger, black. At this point, a male flight attendant appears from first class and asks to be let through. This seems the perfect time to let the woman return to her seat. However, the attendants find a way to block her. You watch the woman's face carefully. She remains outwardly calm, but now her arms are crossed at her waist. The woman beside you shakes her head again as the two attendants make sure to avert their gaze. Unable to remain silent, you stand up and approach the woman, touching her lightly on the shoulder. "I'm sorry," you say, "it's not fair." She gives you a brief smile and says softly, "I'm used to it. I'm patient." She turns back to waiting. Meanwhile, and to your astonishment, the lead flight attendant begins serving people in the row behind you. And the second attendant avoids your gaze again as she takes her time serving her row. The woman bristles with barely concealed anger. You've had enough. You stand up again, ready to confront the flight attendants, but seeing you stand, the woman steps up to the back attendant and asks her to let her through. She repeats herself. It's at this point that the flight attendant moves the cart back and allows the woman to take her seat. The attendant never apologizes, fails to serve the woman her snack or a complimentary beverage. A few minutes later, you overhear the woman across the aisle back ask her seatmate in halting English, "Does this happen a lot here?" And actually, I forgot until I started reading that. I wrote this as a letter to American Airlines, which I sent the next day and received a letter back. And it was a couple weeks later when it came in the news that American Airlines has been being called out for misbehavior and this kind of behavior around African Americans. So I think I wasn't being paranoid.
Well, I love it for so many reasons. One of which is that this happens to all of us all the time. I mean, it's so relatable. And, you know, I think that there's such a universality in these essays and sort of, and I know you probably didn't intend it this way, but a great guidebook, sort of I think a lot of us white middle-aged folk read this and think, yeah, you know, I had an encounter like that just last week. And what would you do? I mean, the question is always, what would you do? Yeah. And so the universality of these essays, I think, is one thing to point out. And the other, you use the second person to great effect, yeah, in a lot of these. And I'd love for you to talk about that when you decide to go into second person. A lot of them are first person because it's memoir, but talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, and you see, I read it was with the first person and I had to back up because it was unconscious. Some of them are past tense, some of the present, some are first, some are third. And actually one was third, but I think I changed it. But the second person, I again, like having McAvoy pointing out the sun kind of thread, I saw the thread of the you and I realized it was too much of it. And so I said, okay, if you're going to use it, you have to use it a certain way. And I only used them in pieces where I felt the universality was heightened and that it was any white guy. And it was like, what would you do? And so I took myself out of it that way. I put a remove, that second person remove. I think it only works. I think it's dangerous to use second person. And I find when they're short pieces, you can pull it off better if you pull it off at all. And here I wanted to kind of have that remove and maybe have the reader step in a little bit. Because, you know, I could be righteous about it. I feel like I did the right thing, but you could also say I was kind of playing that savior role that isn't really helpful sometimes. So, you know, I did what I did, and what I was proud of was that I got to tell her, I see, you know, I can't change it, but because I don't want that person to feel crazy, you know, like they're being made crazy. Like, why is this happening to me? But obviously she had experienced it, you know, over and over.
You had talked a little bit earlier about the essay, Her Hair, which we don't have to read it, but that's another one that's in second person that I wanted to point out, this woman on the elevator who has Alzheimer's. And that went to great effect, I think, because as you're talking about this savior role, it's another example of you kind of taking a heroic, positive role, taking action to help someone else. And I was now thinking about those two essays together. And if that is a role that might be somewhat uncomfortable for you, and therefore you put it into the second person.
You're probably right. You know, I certainly feel like here, you know, heroic, I'm not so sure. Good citizen, definitely. And certainly there are a lot of instances, and I tried to capture some of them, where I'm not a good citizen, where I don't rise to the occasion, or for some reason don't see it in time. I think a lot of us see it just a little late, and then we get home and go, oh man, that happened. I could have done something different about that, but I was too late. You know, it was too quick. And that almost happened here. I was really in my own head. I was in pain and not paying much attention because I was really close to the accident. And, but I caught a glimpse of her. And when she said, you know, where am I? Or something, she asked, what floor is this? It just seemed I just woke up to her. And, my wife often, we traveled to New York City. We used to a lot pre-pandemic, and she'd say, would you stop talking to people? You know, and some of my New Yorker friends would also say the same thing. What are you doing?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because there's a, I guess we talked about this a little bit earlier, but there's a section in here about you talking about a writer's job and being a writer. And I think that's part of it, right? I mean, it is bearing witness, and it is talking to people, getting to know people and trying to understand their point of view. And so, you know, I think it's in that essay, Odd Jobs,
yes,
where you talk about the idea of being a writer. And I think that's part of it. I think that's an important part of the writer's job. So
I don't know. I'd make a bad reporter, but I definitely think this book is a book in the vein of being a reporter. Yeah. That's Odd Jobs is another one where Avery calls me out.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which had to be difficult, is ordering these essays and finding, you know, each essay has to have its internal sense, but the book has to work as a whole, you know, much like a piece of music, you know, you have the individual notes, but the notes also have to work together. And one, I keep using the word device, and I hate to use it, but one method that you used in my mind to link them thematically, obviously they're linked thematically, but you have recurring phrases that you like, blind and blindness and blind spot is one, invisibility is another one. And so you will drop that concept or that word in one essay, and you will pick it up again in either an essay that's juxtaposed to that one or pretty proximate in time, so that the reader has this pleasure of recognition of a prior essay, even if the context is different. I'm sure that was very conscious on your part, but I wondered if you could talk a little bit about putting the collection together and ordering the essays.
I love the idea of a reader having pleasure reading something I've written. Isn't it one of the goals? Definitely. I'm a collage artist. I'm a collageist. I use collage technique in everything I do. It's another kind of thing that I own more fully after the accident. Like, okay, what do you do? What do you do well? What don't you do so well? Maybe you shouldn't do that as much. Maybe you should do more of what you do well. So collage is it. And so those are the things you do when you collage, is that you put pieces, like, you know, literally as a collage artist, you put pieces of paper next to each other and you pattern them and you find juxtapositions that are interesting, and you play with that kind of small pieces of a mosaic, when put together right from a certain point of view, snap into a kind of, you know, clarity, and suddenly are of a whole. And so for me, that's always the goal, is to make each little piece a whole, each section come together as a whole, and then the book come together made up of a quilt of sections. And that's why these little interstitial pieces and the quotes and the photographs, they're used to kind of, like in music, like to make slow things down, pair an image with a quote that then maybe resonates with the next piece, so that you begin to kind of get these chimes. I think long poems do this too.
Well, and the other thing that it allows you to do, and one thing that you're so wonderful at, is a little bit of wordplay. And certainly the title, and in the essay Walking Lubbock, you talk about the title. I wonder if we can just read that graph.
Yeah, I think it's good to mention that one, because the book also, one of the things I did as a way to organize the book was I often use a centerpiece and a sense of a kind of a first half of a pivot and a second half, and the headlines are in the middle, and the coming up to the election and then Trump being made president and the aftermath of that kind of comes around that middle. And in that time, I'm beginning to move out in the world more. So you begin to get less Asheville and Mountain South and Tennessee, and you get more New York City, you know, Lubbock, Sun Valley. I start to travel as a writer again. So, but my friend Curtis, who is one of the friends that this book is dedicated to, Curtis and Vivi, writer friends who inspired me. We were walking around his where he lives in Lubbock, and we're often talking about things like dislocation, a bunch of poets, you know, and he's challenging me a little bit on the idea of dislocation, because I had been in one place for so long. He's always challenging me to think deeper about something. And so he's like, I mentioned this idea of beyond repair, and I'll just read the graph. We've been talking about the state of affairs in Lubbock, in Texas, in the country, trying not to fall into despair. I worry aloud that our world has moved beyond repair. Curtis pushes back on the thought. Is anything really ever beyond repair? I try to explain myself. I mean, why even try to repair something so broken? We bat the idea around. Maybe it's not about systematic failure, as in that car is dead, it's beyond repair, but instead something transformational, as in we need to move beyond repair. Not trying to fix something, but overhauling the whole system, throwing everything out and starting again. And I want to say quickly that I try to show almost entirely in this book and try to get my analysis in small doses of tell. And that's one where I really, the odd jobs is one. And this is another where I really let myself kind of amplify the theme pretty directly that most throughout the book.
Yes. The other thing that you do that I thought was kind of great is you don't really feel the need to introduce characters, you know, like Curtis in this piece, yep. Which is kind of, you know, he's just there. We don't know who he is. And we kind of, and I thought that was kind of great because it made us feel more part of your life. Like, of course we should know who Curtis is, or, you know, of course, I mean, we came to know Avery and your wife, obviously, over the course of them, but there were times when, you know, people would just drop in and, yeah. And it was nice that way, that you didn't feel like you needed a lot of setup, you know, to explain the backstory, that we were just in the moment with these people. And
I'm glad you think so. I think, you know, at the risk, I certainly tried to drop as many kind of, I didn't want to spend time defining people or trying to give a visual description. I thought, let's just get the scene going and hopefully they'll come alive a little bit.
Right. And they did. I thought that was great. I think if we could read Zombieland, because we've talked a lot about race, but we haven't talked a lot about economics and class and social structure is another big theme in this book. And I think, you know, it's kind of worth shedding a little bit of light on. Can we read that one and then we'll talk about that one?
Yeah, Zombieland. And it starts with an epigram. You need three houses or three jobs to live here. Sun Valley saying. I'm in Nevada. I'm in there. I'm visiting a friend. The place looks like a set for an apocalyptic movie or the site of a survivalist compound shootout. Two abandoned SUVs in the driveway, tires flat, and a wind-down sapling drooped against the front door awning. You peer inside. A soccer ball has come to rest at a basket of laundry. Dishes are stacked on the counter. The dust coating piles of boxes and hoarder mind spreads like mold. You can imagine the man, estranged from his family, wife long moved out. One day, in the act of putting on water on for coffee, saying to himself, F it. He puts the kettle down and turns off the flame, then heads for the door, grabbing a hat in the foyer. He stops and turns at the fence for one last look, long enough to curse the property, hand flapped out in a disgusted wave. I'm out of here. 5 years later, the fence has fallen to the ground. Scrub oaks have taken over. What sold for $1.2 million now only a line item on some bookkeeper's ledger. Neighbor's property values plunging. You wonder if the guy's just out of the country, or maybe his wife came out to the property one day and shot him, buried him out back. Maybe she took the money in the safe and hightailed it out there. Either way, raccoons have taken up residence in the rusty suburban out front.
Maybe I like it because I was born in Sun Valley. I don't know.
Well, you know, it was such a surreal, my friend lives in a kind of nice neighborhood. I mean, really nice neighborhood, and all the houses were huge. And I was kind of blown away and kind of disgusted at the same time, which I often am in those kind of neighborhoods. And she has a really interesting kind of, you know, mixed feeling about the neighborhood as well. And she was really excited that I paid attention to that property, because all the things I imagine that imagine, everything that I imagined that man imagining or feeling was really all the gossip that she described around that house in the neighborhood. And it was something that people talked about. They wondered, was there was a husband and wife, and there was a fight, and did she come back and kill him, or where is he? And so, you know, but these are all, you know, real first world concerns. And this is the kind of, this is the life of that 1% in a way, or, you know, 5% or whatever it is. And it's, I'm curious about it. And I'm, you know, and I'm also kind of disgusted by it at the same time. But it's, you know, race and class are hand in hand. They always have been.
Well, to that end, I wonder if we could also read Gentrified, which is a little bit of a longer piece, but it feels like a really nice counterpoint to this piece, because it's a similar situation where you've walked into a neighborhood that's not your own. You've noticed this dilapidated property that for completely different reasons, right? And one is a real commentary on class and middle class whiteness gone bad, maybe, or whatever was happening in Zombieland. And the other is all about race. And I don't know if it makes sense to read those two next to each other, but they do seem resonant with each other. Or maybe I'm misreading something.
Oh, I think you are. No, I think you're right on. I'd be happy to. It's more complicated because this is my wife's family's town. They weren't always happy there. Andover, Massachusetts. It's really it's a very white town and very gentrified. And so their relationship to their neighbors was complicated. And so I had a much more sympathetic kind of feeling about the whole situation because I was interacting with people I love and know really well. But at the same time, I was really interested and kind of confused by the whole situation. So I just thought I'd try. This is what piece that I took a long time to write and a lot of editing. But it starts with a quote from a great book called Black Walden by Elise Lemire. The history of slavery and its aftermath reveals that at least some of the nation's cherished green spaces began as black spaces, which is a whole great idea that this doesn't really come to, but in some ways it just touches upon. Mm-hmm. After a long day of travel and a night of uneven sleep, I slipped out of Allie's parents' house before everyone gathered for breakfast. I passed down through a young apple orchard and was halfway down the block before I walked past a dilapidated one-story house, an anomaly on this New England street of fancy remodeled homes. I had walked by it dozens of times and never quite noticed the dead elm standing in the heart of its wild field, nor the uneven line of an old stone wall further in, nor the beat-up truck hidden in plain sight just beside the dilapidated barn. The reason why no one but the neighbors ever see this place, and then only to grumble about property values or imagine what they do with it, with the land, is that it no longer belongs here, not in this condition, not among all these upsized homes. And I don't usually see it because I'm not expecting to find the past plopped squarely inside the shiny present. Later, over a buffet lunch, I asked about the property. I was told that it was owned by an old man, one of two brothers still alive. He was ill, so it didn't come out. He didn't come out much anymore. The only African-American man, my mother-in-law added, left in the neighborhood. My unexpressed thought, how many lived here in the first place? And how long ago? When I pressed for more information, Diane shook her head. No one gets to know each other very deeply on this block. She looked resigned by this fact, and I believed her. Still, when I looked up the town's census figures online, I discovered that in a town of over 300,000, there were less than 125 black residents. Its most famous black citizen, Cato Freeman, dead now for 165 years. In The Color of Law, Richard Rothstein noted that in one popular history book used in public schools, 2012 edition, out of 1,000 pages, there was just one sentence on the subject of segregation. Quote, African Americans found themselves forced into segregation, unquote. That's it, Rothstein wrote. One passive voice sentence. No suggestion of who might have done this forcing or how it was implemented. The family, the gossip around town went, was expected to sell the property, and another McMansion would rise up in its place, as if it were a foregone conclusion that they would uproot and find a more welcoming place. But why this expectation? Might someone in the family decide to keep the house, fix it up, and start a new family there? They could midwife it even deeper into its wild state, start a garden, raise bees, cut down the dead tree and plant a new one, fix up the stone wall and talk over it like Frostwood with the neighbors further up the hill. I imagined this as I headed out the next morning, again searching out a little solitary time. I resisted the Thoreauvian urge to trespass further into the field. More than likely, though, this place would be gone the next time I came here, and maybe even I won't remember its former presence.
That was Sebastian Matthews reading from his collection, Beyond Repair. The piece is Gentrified. And I
I think endings are so difficult, especially I write short stories, but I think short story essays, these small essays, the endings have to be both resonant, but they can't be tidy and too cleaned up, you know, like a novel. And your endings are so that way, you know, they're so brilliant. I think the challenge for a book like this, for short stories and essays, is the two hardest things are endings and titles, and you have to do them over and over and over again.
Well, a lot.
Yeah, you have to do it a lot. Talk a little bit about when you know you've stuck a landing.
That's a good way to put it. Oftentimes, it's the editing, the cutting that sticks the landing. You create the landing after the fact by cutting out the weaker writing or find the place that really should be the ending. But otherwise, it's just a feel. You know, this is where my writing poems for years kind of comes in, where you. It's all, for me, it's voice, and a voice, if you start it right and you find the music of the voice, the sound of sense, as Frost calls it, the kind of mixture of speaking voice and the music of poetry, but I think prose has poetry in it too. If you get that and you really pay attention to it, you're attentive to it, I think that the shape of the piece comes kind of naturally or organically, and I usually come pretty close to the sticking the ending. And if I haven't done it, I can do it in the revising.
So everything you said strikes me as something you could also use maybe when you're choosing titles, which is my other Achilles heel. I think they're so hard. Sometimes the title is found in the text. Sometimes it's not. And I don't know if you get a sense for that, but it also seems, as you're talking about musicality and lyricism and poetry, all of those things sound like the right path you're on to get the right title.
Definitely. And, you know, it's another way to mention this idea of magnifying or magnification or amplification. A fiction writing friend of mine talked about those ways that novelists can kind of cheat and speak really directly or amplify the theme, just kind of to say, you know what, I'm just going to tell you what I'm writing about here. Sorry. And they can get away with it if they do it right. And I think one way you can amplify themes is in titles, right? People accept them because it's like, okay, this is what this piece is called. But over time, you can kind of, like you were saying, like certain words, certain patterns of, you know, words, you can, the titles can do that too. So X marks the spot kind of has a resonance to it. You know, I'm just looking through, one is called Welcome. Even a title like Blue Nude, which is about going into a Matisse show, something about that title resonates for me and connects to other pieces. Or like the next piece in it is about going to another art exhibit. So there's kind of ways to chime the different subject matters and themes.
Yes, right. And I love it when you do that. Yeah, when you can feel the resonance between the two pieces. Yeah, and you're right. Titles is a great way to, even if the titles don't appear in the piece, but a word appears one place and then it appears in another title. I think there's a piece called Invisible that does that. There's a concept of invisibility that's discussed, and then a couple of pieces later, there's a title piece, if I'm recalling this right, that's called Invisible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great technique.
You were mentioning endings, and I was thinking about the ending of the book too, and I was beginning to try to think how I would answer it. And I realized that one way that a book ends, there's a lot of different ways to end a book, but if you end a book of a collage book of a mosaic of themes and stories, you kind of have to tie together four or five endings. And that's kind of, I tried to end this without feeling like you're kind of getting these, you know, an ending of a book told to you over and over again. I wanted to kind of put some of the themes kind of to bed. And so that by the end of the book, you kind of feel like you've come around kind of full circle.
And that piece does that so beautifully, so beautifully.
The Shooter. Yeah.
Should we end on just you rereading that piece?
I'd be happy to. It's, you know, my son's going into senior year, but you know, it's all online now. So this reality, in one good way, one good thing you can think about, there's so many things that are so not good about all the kids going online, is that they don't have to live a life in school where they're worried about being killed. And so, but this comes from a place of a parent being worried about that. It's called Shooter. Sitting here in my car, once again, waiting for my boy to get out of school, though Avery's no longer a boy and school is high school. At 3:30, the doors will knock open and students will stream out heading up the hill, some climbing into waiting cars, some, the seniors, making for their own cars, others walking home or to work or to practice. I come early to nab a spot up front, happy to wait for the gift of getting to drive out unencumbered. I bring my work, a book, a crossword, or I read the news on my phone. If weather is good, I roll down the windows and play some music, or I abandon the car and walk circles along the outside of the upper lot. When it's cold, I hunker down, engine turned off, and focus on the work at hand. But on days like today, the one-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting, all I can think of is an active shooter appearing at one of the doors, of students running and screaming from the building, of cop cars pulling up, the sound of automatic gunfire. I can't help imagining the scene, wondering what I would do in such a moment, what any of us would in our cars would do. When I calm down and bring myself back to the lazy, slow afternoon, I begin to wonder what makes someone become a mass shooter, about the conditions it takes. And I don't buy the line that these men, so often young men, young white men, act alone, that they are mentally unstable. They may be, in fact, mentally unstable or battling trauma or in some way out of their right mind, but our culture has helped make them this way, prime them to be violent in this way. Brainwashed, they come out of a specific situation, environment, training ground. Students start streaming out of the school, not screaming. The students start streaming out of the school. One of the teachers puts on a traffic vest and starts waving cars forward. I search the crowd, finally spotting Avery as he hikes up the grassy hill outside the old gym. He's grown so much, has come so far from the 8-year-old boy who climbed out of that ruined car, unsure if his parents were going to make it. It's hard to believe that 7 years have passed. Avery spots the car and heads my way. He looks into the side window to make sure he has chosen the right silver Subaru, flipping his hair unconsciously before he opens the door and climbs in. Hey, Dad. He plugs in his phone and turns up the hip hop.
You know, that Freudian slip that you made with the students come screaming out of the school is, I'm sure, not totally unintentional on the subconscious level. I mean, I think that was a good one.
And I didn't mean to, but it's there. It's right there underneath it. I didn't realize that streaming and screaming were so similar to each other.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I realized reading that is, and it's, I don't think, and this is another way that you don't have to always, you know, I made a little mini lecture there about, you know, what kind of the white supremacist male. But really, there are a lot of things I don't have to really bring out to the foreground if I've done other things right. And, you know, if you look at that, you can see so much white privilege and so much male privilege in that opening. You know, I'm a full-time writer and a half-time teacher. I can afford to get there early. I can be comfortable walking around in a parking lot and not worried that I'm going to get stopped by the police. I mean, there's so many ways that when you start looking at things like your own white privilege, you begin to realize, wow, you know, I've got a lot of room here, and maybe other people don't. So I just wanted to bring that up because it's kind of, it's embedded in that piece without talking about it.
That's right. That's right. And that brings up the theme. There was a essay earlier in the book on trespassing, which addresses that head on. And you're right. This last essay sums up so many of the prior essays into one. I'd have to fact check this, but I heard somewhere that March, the month that we closed down 2020, was the first month in this century that we had not had a school shooting. And
wow.
I need to fact check that, but I saw it and I was so struck and horrified by that it, you know, to kind of stop me in my tracks. But
you know, there's so many things that are awful about what's been going on. And of course, all the inequities that have been exposed, it's a catastrophe on so many levels. And it's probably a privileged thing to be able to say, but I find there's some of the silver linings are incredible. Like what you just pointed out and kind of were made aware of, or to realize that there was so much environmental, you know, the pause on the environment was so helpful for our globe. You know, and maybe psychologically, I know there's been a lot of trauma and depression and, you know, lots of stuff that have been negative, but I think a lot of people have felt there's also a chance to rethink things. I don't think the response to the George Floyd murder could have been as deep and as fully heard in a more busy time. I mean, things like that. We have a chance to change things now, and that comes out of this pause in a way.
Which is the title of your book, right? Are we beyond repair, or is it a repair that's something beyond, you know, it's not just fixing what was broken. It's kind of restarting over.
Doing something else. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Into something else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any advice that we should have talked about that has sustained you along the way that we haven't mentioned, or words of wisdom?
You know, the thing that comes to mind is that, you know, perseverance. I know that's been a theme yesterday in the DNC. Joe Biden is the great man train, but perseverance in writing goes a long way. I've never felt that I was the most brilliant writer, the most talented. I never felt that I needed to be heard, but I felt like I wanted to be part of a conversation as a writer and wanted to earn a spot in a group of writers who I respect in a time, you know, and to speak to something that's important. And so I wouldn't have made it here to had a chance to do that for whatever it's worth. If I gave up, you know, the four or five times I wanted to, and, you know, whether you're got the big contract or you're making enough money or you feel like you're not being respected or whatever, it's really not the point. It's easy to say that, but you have to get back to that over and over again. And it's basically just one foot in front of the other. It's one of the reasons why I can write a book like Beyond Repair is that when I wasn't really clear of how to write fiction or to move forward, I would just make myself write a scene. And the Beginner's Guide to a Head-On Collision, I wrote a poem a day for 3 months with a couple months over the month break in between each month. And I forced myself to write about, you know, literally moment by moment after the accident. That kind of just do it small bits and keep doing it every day goes a long way.
Long way. Great advice. Great advice. And you have a great website. We can follow you there, which I think is just your name?
Yeah, it's been updated. I think it's a lot better than it was. SebastianMatthews.com. You can learn more about like the radio show I do and American Crow. And it's there if you stumble upon it.
I love it. And if you do Zoom and virtual events, hopefully they'll be posted there so people can keep watching you. And you've got some great prior interviews up there as well. So
thanks for reminding me. There's, you know, everything's changed. The gigs I thought I had planned are now either not there or they're Zoom gigs. So
some advantages to that because I get to attend a lot more than I used to be able to. But yeah, it's a hard time for writers to be releasing books. I totally get it.
And like a local bookstore reading suddenly has a chance to be much more.
Yes. Yes, as long as we buy our books from the local bookstore, that's exactly right. Exactly right. Oh, this was wonderful. Sebastian Matthews, thank you so much. And what a wonderful book.
Oh, Marie, thank you so much for reading it and appreciating it and letting me talk with you on the show. I'm looking forward to hearing more of what you do.
That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.